It's just this game makes me insane. I wonder where we go.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and our panel discussion for this Monday morning. It is the 10th of September, 13 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. Good morning and welcome. Let me just remind you that you can always join in on the conversation. We love when you do so. panel@wamc.org, and you can join in. Let me introduce the panel to you, and then we will get started. We are pleased that he has made the trip up the Northway once again, or the Thruway, I should say.
A little bit of everything.
I think. That's right. You got a little... you take quite the tour of the highways and byways of New York State. Executive editor of the Times-Herald Record, Barry Lewis, is with us. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning, Joe.
We also welcome back Albany Law School professor who also directs the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson. Good morning, Sarah. How
are
you?
Good morning. I'm doing well, thank you.
Excellent. And James Ketterer, Dean of International Studies at Bard College and Academic Director of the Bard Globalization and International Affairs Program. Good morning, James. How are you?
Good morning. Nice to be back.
Very nice to have you. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Joe, and to you and to all of our listeners. Shana Tova. Happy New Year. It's a very deep time for many people of Jewish persuasion who have to search inwardly and take a look at themselves.
And here we are. Good morning and welcome. Let's get to the topics on hand today and talk about what is going on in the news. A lot of it is, I would say some of it is a holdover from what happened last week. The Vice President of the United States was all over the Sunday shows. I shouldn't say he, but Trump surrogates basically trying to say that there really isn't a resistance movement within the Trump administration. Vice President Pence was on Fox News Sunday, as well as Face the Nation. Not only said that he would take a lie detector test to prove that he hadn't written the anonymous New York Times piece, but that he would do so in a heartbeat. He disputed the veracity of an episode in Bob Woodward's new book, which is Fear, is the name of the book, and it's coming out tomorrow, which depicts a White House in chaos, even when confronted with a document backing up the veteran journalist's reporting. In an unusual move, he requested an opportunity to go back on camera and revise his response to a question on whether anyone on his staff had written the op-ed, telling CBS's Margaret Brennan he was 100% confident no one on his team was involved, after earlier responding that he just wouldn't know. So when did that memo come in?
Well, I think one of the things that happened...
Was that like a green room tweet afterwards? Like, oh, get back on the television.
By the way.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that everybody knows is that Donald Trump may not communicate with you individually, but he does watch television. And when he sees something he doesn't like, he lets people know that he didn't like it, and that's sort of where it is. So... I think people are living in a certain kind of fear of this guy now, with the Woodward book, in which all of these revelations are coming out, and now with the anonymous op-ed piece, which we can fight about whether it's, a legitimate way to go or not. I'd love to hear from Barry what he would have done in that situation if you had such a person.
I'm not a proponent of anonymous. Right. I don't think the New York Times is generally either. I think if I was put in that situation where, and I think as many have said, it must be a very high-ranking person in the Trump administration, or I don't think the Times would have allowed it if it was some middle-level administrative official, because they know what the fallout's going to be, and they know that in time, eventually, this person's going to come out, or this person's identity is going to come out for sure. So I'm not in favor of it. But if it's somebody within the cabinet, if it's someone who is truly high up there and can give some great context, which I'm guessing what the Times did, in light of the Woodward book, I would have probably have gone along. But I think it also would have taken some extraordinary level in the administration to have allowed that. But I guess I'm out of favor, because what it does is once you allow for anonymous, you lose the credibility. you know, and you know, that argument of that you can't stand behind what somebody is saying.
But it is interesting, isn't it, gang, that, to watch them scurrying around, one after another.
Fun or interesting?
Well, you know what? The other part is that they're making them take their, like, you know, they're making them sign affidavits and take maybe possible consider lie detector tests. And, well, of course they're going to say no. The great source in journalism history, one of the greats, Deep Throat himself, Mark Phelps, denied that he was Deep Throat. And 30 years later,
he was.
He was. Shocking.
Well, they said after he was always when upon his death.
But that's why everyone, nobody in this administration is going to admit it. At some point, they will if they have the courage or they feel safe enough that they can.
I thought it was interesting that Bob Woodward, when asked about this, said he wouldn't have run it.
Do you think I watched that and I wasn't sure it was a little bit self-serving?
Yeah.
By saying that, he says, well, you know, my standards are higher than that of the New York Times and it sells more books.
Yeah. I think this, in many ways, I think the op-ed helped his book. I think it helped. But I'm not surprised by the New York Times timing of it. I don't think that they had it, you know, just 24 hours before they published it. So I think there was a period of time where they had it. And I don't think it was a coincidence that they ran it just when the book came out, because it added to the authenticity of what Woodward was reporting.
I really want to hear from our two professors here on this, but I do want to ask what the motivation for the Times is, which is that these are incredibly terrible times. This could be the end of the Republic and the Democratic part of the Republic as we know it. And the Times comes back and they say, okay, you know, this kind of stuff is not justified under normal circumstances, as you've said, Barry. But in this case, when history looks back at what happened here as we come down to the end of the fork in the road, did we go the fascist way or did we go to buttress democracy? We want to be counted as somebody who did something extraordinary here. Jim?
Yeah, I think Woodward and the New York Times both have the same motivation. They want to they're news presenters, right? And the difference between what Woodward was doing, what the Times was doing, is that the Times was approached. That was a submission.
That's interesting,
right? And Woodward was out there soliciting information, using contacts that he's established over decades of relationships to gather information and be deliberate and put together a book, as opposed to a timely. Surprising. I heard an interview of the journalist at the New York Times who actually was responsible for vetting this op-ed. He met the author. I don't know. He had contact with the author, he mentioned. And so it was something that they thought very carefully about. But I think the interview really revealed that he just wanted to make sure that this voice had a platform because it sounded urgent and that there was some sort of like a moral imperative.
But
to
you
the
can't
piece.
Believe for a second, can you guys, that it didn't go all the way up to Sulzberger sitting at the top of the heap?
Well, they said it did.
Yeah, and I'd like to think about, well, what was that conversation like? Because it seems to me that at some point somebody at the Times must have been saying, and maybe not, but I would assume that they did, that look, you know, we're a newspaper. We're sitting on an incredible news story here. This person wants to use us as a platform to put out something anonymous for their own purposes, many of which I think seem quite self-serving, as well as, you know, maybe we could applaud it or applaud the insights into what's going on in the White House. But the news story, I think, is that you have people in the White House who apparently are acting on their own behalf against the wishes of an elected president. Now, we might approve of that because we don't like the president, but that's still a huge news story. And at what point would the Times say, you know, you don't get that pass? Like, we know who you are. This is a big news story. And we're not going to give you an anonymous op-ed. We're going to run the news story.
I think there was probably some level of agreement a lot of what the person had written is well known. there wasn't a great deal of surprise. I think maybe the idea of the papers coming off the desk and who was taking them off the desk. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, this idea of people within the administration having insulted the president or carefully orchestrating and trying to cover up for the president, I don't think is new. That it came from somebody within the White House in real time, I think is what brought that a different level.
It does get antsy. I mean, somebody wrote us a letter just over the weekend and said, okay, so let's say an enterprising New York Times reporter gets a hold of the idea that who it is, finds out who it is. Is that reporter permitted in the news sections of the New York Times to identify that person? In other words, if you read, it's always very interesting to me, if you read this sort of disclaimer at the top of the New York Times editorials, it always says the editorial page is different from the news pages.
Right.
Well, is it?
Yes.
Well, okay. So you're
telling me it is because the reporters we have letters to the editor, we have editorials which we reporters find out often, and some editors find out often for the first time when it's published.
So you're telling
there is a separation.
Yeah. Well, Barry? Do you sit on your editorial board?
Yes.
Your paper? Oh, but you're also the chief news gatherer, right?
I am the overall editor. Yes.
Yes, and so. I had a very good friend of mine, an editor, say, it's not news unless I say it's news. Do you have that position at your paper, too?
I have a lot of smart people surround me, so I think I'm not a dictator. And I think that's a dangerous thing to do in a newsroom.
No,
yes.
But you're the top guy.
Right.
And you're on the editorial board.
Correct.
And you also are calling the shots in terms of news gathering,
correct.
Right?
Our publisher is also on the editorial board, and
that's
our
right.
publisher has the ultimate final
sure,
say.
It's the publisher's page.
It's a publisher's, right, and it's a publisher's paper in many ways. I mean, it's his newspaper. But I think if you're running a good journalism, a good newspaper, everybody understands their place. I have a publisher who, you know, runs the newspaper but stays out of the newsroom and understands, you know, the walls that are there.
So the publisher never picks up the telephone and says to you or to anybody else, not you have to run this story, but isn't this an interesting thing? Maybe we could do that story.
I have a publisher who has asked a question about a story, but has never said, you know, or has maybe just said, did we check on something?
No, but I'm talking about, you know,
no.
I get ideas all the time. You know, I've been known to say, should we look at this? And quite frequently, I'm ignored.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Somebody takes
yes.
the paper right off your
yes,
desk.
Our publisher has said, hey, how are we looking into this? Or have we? Or, you know, whatever the case may be. And I may say, yes, we are, or we will, or we just don't have the manpower right now. But that's a prerogative. Any reader can do that.
So from a social science point of view, Jim, what do you think is going on here in terms of news? What are academics going to think of all of this?
Well, I mean, I think the role of the Times in deciding to do this, and, you know, Barry, you've talked about how difficult it must be and how, you know, they must have made a decision that this was so important. The Times are so unusual. But I go back to what I was saying before. You know, what is actually happening in the conduct of government on a daily basis? And I think that there is some surprise to it in a way that we have now, apparently, if we can believe it from an anonymous source, we have someone saying this is what is happening exactly in the White House, and this is how we are resisting it. What are the longer term implications for the country in the governance of the country to say, well, it is now okay for unelected members on their own to decide what to do?
Yeah, it's very dangerous because I think, you know, our founding fathers were smart enough to realize we want civilians to oversee the military. And what we have right now is we have some folks and some other military people who have decided that President 45 is not capable of making these decisions. And so when he makes a decision, we're going to ignore that. And we may as a society or maybe with a political bent say, thank God for that. But that's not the way this should be working, because the next president, we don't want the administration to be saying, we're going to ignore the president's orders.
Okay, so let me put my tongue in my cheek and do something I hate to do, which is to basically present the Trump side of this. He says they're lying. The guy's lying. That's not the way it is here. We got a smooth, beautifully operating White House here. That person who wrote that editorial, which is unsigned, and by the way, that's a bad word. It's not an editorial. It's an op-ed piece,
correct,
and people make that mistake all the time. But who wrote that op-ed is full of baloney. That is not the way things are working, and we don't have any name on the piece.
But you have a history now within this administration of this president who lies multiple times a day, every day, since he's been, actually before he's been in office. And you now have more than just one source. So you have this op-ed piece, which follows the Woodward book, which follows the Omarosa book, which follows the other
Mike Wolff
book, which follows...
And countless articles
And countless
written.
Articles of which people within the administration have been quoted as saying he's an idiot, and they're out. And so this is just another level. So it makes it tougher for, I think, the president to say, this is not true, ignore what you're seeing, which he often likes to say
and
anyways.
Which he is saying.
Yes, which he does say. So I think his credibility is deeply hampered.
Well, and why didn't the author go to a conservative publication? Why did they choose the New York Times? I think it goes all the way back to the campaign when the deputy general counsel, David McGraw, who is actually an Albany Law alum, wrote that letter that went viral that said, we will not retract. We will not, you know, we won't back down from you, President Trump. You have no right to threaten the New York Times about information that we're publishing related to things that you've done in your life that do not make you fit to be in the presidency. So very, very interesting that somebody from within this administration would choose that particular news outlet to present their case. Given the relationship between the president and the New York Times from the beginning.
We have to take a break. We'll talk about this more when we come back. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Hearing from the band Real Estate, who will be playing at Helsinki Hudson on Thursday, the 13th of September, Thursday night. And you can find out more by going to HelsinkiHudson.com. People asking about the music can always go to WAMC.org/roundtable, where we have a full playlist posted there. And you can find out the different tunes that we play during the breaks. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Alan has a few in front of him. We'll get to those right now, and then we'll move on to other stuff.
Good morning, panel. What is the biggest issue with respect to journalism ethics and the op-ed piece? If I'm teaching budding journalists, what is the risk in accepting an op-ed piece from a source labeled anonymous, even if the paper knows who it is? Is it public perception? What is the paper's responsibility to truth versus perception? Thank you, Bernard. And what I love about letters like this, and it's a very good letter, of course, comes the legal thing at the bottom, which says this message is intended for use only in the by the individual.
What?
It's a gray line. There's no black or white, and I don't think papers take it lightly, and I don't think the Times did, nor would we. You just don't do it often. But you look at what is the value of what is being sent in and who is the person that's doing it, and you measure that.
That disclaimer at the bottom usually means it was a lawyer that sent it.
No, I know.
So, but no, I think we should think more about the role of lawyers in journalism, too. I mean, the New York Times certainly consulted their lawyers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And like you said, it went to the publisher. They understood. They knew. And that's why they understand that once it comes out there, if it turns out to be somebody who is – you know, a middle manager person who they could give a title of supervisor, they would look really silly. And that's why it is somebody either in a cabinet, in a hierarchy post, an ambassador
to Russia.
Or an ambassador.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
And so Hope says, good morning. Just saw a documentary over the weekend named Active Measures by Jack Bryan. It starts with Putin on through Trump. Follows along the line of Malcolm Nance's book. Well worth seeing. It is mind-blowing, scary, and in my mind, everybody should see. It interviews quite a few people, including Hillary Clinton and John McCain. Keep up the great work that you all do, and that's warm regards from Hope. And Anonymous says, I'm less curious about who Anonymous is than why he or she wrote the op-ed in the first place. If we accept the writer's premise that there are White House staff working to save the country by frustrating the president's worst impulses, why in the world would he or she expose and therefore complicate that effort? That makes no sense at all to me. Thoughts?
My thought was that it's weeks before these crucial midterm elections and some really important primaries. And if you're the Republican Party, don't you want to send a message to your constituents that things are under control, no matter how far off the rails this presidency is? I mean, that was my immediate thought. I'm sure that's a very cynical view of this situation. But from a Republican standpoint, it might make sense. There's no stronger campaign message right now than there are adults in the room.
Mm. What if it were just, I'm sorry to do this, always playing that role, just selfishness? What if the person wanted to stay, just wanted to stay, and wanted to throw the monkey wrench into the works? That is possible, too, that there wasn't a higher purpose except, you know, sort of self-protection.
But there is a concern also that this person realizes the dangers of what is going on and how close. And it reminds me of these, you know, the suddenly lawmakers getting profiles in Courage because they're no longer going to seek re-election.
Sure.
You know, nobody who is seeking re-election has the nerve to say anything bad about Trump. You know, dare they feel the wrath of the GOP. You know, this person clearly understands what is at stake. Come forward. You know,
I think the person should come forward.
Yeah. Sure, and speak out and say, I'm willing to take whatever punishment there is, whatever wrath there is, but this is serious stuff. And, you know, I think we're talking about, you know, you're thinking of things that they're taking off the president's table in terms of, you know, attacking, killing foreign leaders and, you know, and going invading countries. And this isn't the kind of stuff that they should be playing political games with.
Yeah, I think one of the questions is, why did the person write the piece and want to publish it? The second one is, why do they want to stay anonymous? You know, nobody who's working in the West Wing is there just for a job. They're not staying anonymous just because they want to keep their job. So, you know, do they want to stay in place after having roiled the waters like this? You know, what other value do they see in the anonymity in doing this, as opposed to coming out in front, meeting with members of Congress, agreeing to meet with Mueller, et cetera? You know, whatever wrath there might be would be balanced off against the value of their position.
Well, let's just look at it the other way. Let's just say, for whatever reason, they want to stay. And let's look at Comey. Who? Remember Comey? He did the right thing. He told the truth. Goodbye, so long. Been good to know you. And so the impact of his doing it this way is so much greater than any of the roadkill that are lying on the side of the highway.
Including national security clearances.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. I have a strong suspicion that this is somebody with military or intelligence ties, because it has to be somebody who knows how to get this kind of information through channels, to keep it confidential, and still be able to put their finger on the pulse. His most dangerous impulses are about national security. And when you read it, you can tell it's someone who has thought deeply about what it means to be an American. So it just, to me, that was the second thought I had, was that it must be somebody in the military or intelligence who knows enough to know how dangerous it is and how to cover their tracks.
And who is who is very bright, Sarah, who is, if it's to be believed, is dropping key words into the thing that belong to other people, like Mike Pence, for example. Now, that, if that turns out to be the case, that's pretty brilliant.
Yeah, but like James said, you kind of wonder why these people are, you know, is this kind of the General Kelly idea, that they're staying into, they feel that they can do better to help and protect their country by staying in there, even though General Kelly admits that this may have been the worst job he's ever taken or will ever take in his life. So you ask the question, why would a man in his position continue to endure this? And supposedly his response is, and again, I have some questions with it as well, but I think, you know, his response is, or it appears to be, at, you know, you serving, you're doing for the country.
Yeah. So that could be a rationale. Of course, I just want to stay here. I want to have the influence I've got.
Right.
And I don't want to bail, you know, for personal reasons rather than because it's, everybody says what they're doing is for the country, including Trump.
Right. Well, and that's what leads to this further norm erosion.
Yeah.
What's the last norm we want eroded in a democracy? A military coup. So.
Right, yeah.
John McCain seems to be the last person who ever said, I'm doing it for my country, and we believed him.
Hmm.
You know, when John McCain continued to stand up, when he put his thumb down on the health care vote, when he pulled the microphone away from the woman and said, no, Obama's a good citizen, it seems like that was the last. Those are those instances where we heard somebody actually say, I'm doing it for my country, and we believed this person.
When you say we believe, 90% of the Republican Party believe in Donald Trump. Every poll shows it. They're not getting off of the dime. The last poll I saw before John McCain died, 40% of those Republicans believed in him. So it's not that we can speak as we believe, because obviously there are a lot of people who don't feel the same way.
I sadly stand corrected, because you're absolutely right. You know, it should be the other way around, and you're right. Even the folks who, you know, call us or send us emails regarding Trump, and, you know, you start to talk to folks, and I don't like the man, and I wouldn't want to have lunch with him, and I don't like him, and he's disgusting. But, you know, he's not a politician, he's a business guy, and he does things differently, and he does it his own way. And so then they go to the rationale as to why they're accepting of what he's doing.
Yeah, because on policy positions, he's right exactly where the Republican Party has moved over the last 10 years, with so many members from the Tea Party in the House, et cetera. And the, you know, on tax cuts, Supreme Court nominations, immigration,
et cetera. Which is why Mitch McConnell stays quiet. As long as he can get his judges in there, that'll be fine. You know, once these judges go through, you know, once Trump has served his purpose for the conservative or Republican or whatever is left of that party, you know, maybe then they'll start to speak up.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll return and continue with other topics. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Les Moonves, the longtime chief executive of the CBS Corporation, stepped down Sunday night from the company that he has led for 15 years. His fall from Hollywood's highest echelon was all but sealed after the publication earlier in the day of new sexual harassment allegations against him. The CBS board announced his departure effective immediately. As part of the agreement, the network said it would donate $20 million to one or more organizations that support equality for women in the workplace. The donation will be deducted from a potential severance benefit to Mr. Moonves, although he could still walk away with more than $120 million, according to two people familiar with the settlement agreement. Mr. Moonves, however, will not receive any severance payment until the completion of an independent investigation into the allegations. The board said he could also receive nothing based on the investigation's results. What are the chances of that happening, do you think?
Slimmed. Why is everyone looking at me? I'm just kidding.
The lawyer in the room.
The lawyer in the room.
Slim to none at this point. I mean, the Me Too movement has really pushed a lot of things forward, and we're seeing more light being brought on to these types of horrible practices that have been going on in the entertainment industry in particular for decades. So it's sad that it's so unsurprising. And I think it's telling that I'm not very optimistic. The $20 million donation is a nice touch, but is just a shadow compared to the $120 million potential payout to someone who's been doing this over the course of an entire career.
Very long time.
Why don't you remind us, doing what?
Sexual harassment.
Yeah,
in the workplace.
There are very specific accusations here. You know, very specific.
And these accusations coming out again from the reporting from Ronan Farrow, who I'll just say is a Bard graduate.
Yeah.
He's on this story, and I'm always curious as to, well, what's the next story? You know, where is he headed next?
Yeah, there's this joke about the line of there's no greater fear than somebody saying Ronan Farrow's on the phone for you.
Well, right, but the first go round, there was the first story that was published in The New Yorker by Ronan Farrow about Les Moonves, and at that point it seemed like he withstood it. And then round two came, and then because it was really quiet for a really long time, and then from my reading of what happened yesterday, is the bricks started to fall very, very quickly.
But Joe, the question is, Charlie Rose has accusations and harassment of women coming forward against him and is immediately fired.
By?
CBS.
Les Moonves.
By Les Moonves, who is able, as you say, to somehow escape that first go-around. And it took another go-around for him. And even now, it's, well, we're looking at payout, but we'll see how the investigation plays out. There is certainly a double standard that we're seeing here by whoever is the boss over all these people.
Like Billy Bush and the president?
Yeah.
Right.
I mean,
right.
So the higher it goes, the longer it takes to bring them down.
I mean, Harvey Weinstein is a perfect example of the longer it goes. It could go for decades.
And God knows there are a few people on the planet I detest more than Billy Bush. But let me just say.
Is there a list?
But you're absolutely right. I mean, he was working for NBC at the time. They knew, they had the story, and yet. Yeah, he loses his job, and the other guy becomes president of the United States. He's gone, pretty much. What's he doing now?
No idea.
And that's the fascinating part of this.
And as we've seen last week, NBC is now trying to come up with ways to explain why they did not run the original
Ronan Farrow story,
which it appears as though you have people within that news operation who are contradicting what the news president has said. Why they did not.
And so in the Les Moonves case, so you wonder, well, okay, I'm picking this up from what Jim said a moment ago. Yeah, so what's next? I mean, does it make a difference? I mean, is it a cleaning of house? And then how do we as a culture and as a society and even in the microcosm of entertainment clean that up?
It's not shocking that most of the people at the higher echelons of these large organizations are men.
Right.
One of the solutions is the gender equality argument. The more women, and studies have borne this out, that the more women in higher positions of power, the lower the risk of these types of things happening. You know, bringing women into a more equal environment in the workplace isn't just about not sexually harassing them. It's about actually elevating professional women into positions of power.
Not always. Let me give you an example, if I may.
Sure.
One of the people I trust and like the most in the world is the president of WNYC, and she's a woman, Laura Walker. And there were plenty of problems there, even though she was at the head of the organization. Otherwise, I buy your argument completely.
Sure. An anecdote, you could find an anecdote around all of these issues, but the data, the aggregate data show that certainly these incidents decrease in a statistically significant manner when you have more women in power. Women are not represented, and certainly women of color are not represented in these higher echelons of power and control, which is what all of this is about. And that's what this issue is about. And until we change the dynamics of power and control in the workplace and in how we as Americans view success, then we're not gonna move the dial as much as we need to on this.
But I think also there's a strategic choice to start off these series of articles looking at the entertainment industry. It's a good way to get lots of people's attention. You know, people are across the board pay attention to the movies, to what's on TV, et cetera. But what Sarah is describing is the case in industries across the board. I mean, Ronan Farrow also wrote a very good book about diplomacy, about his time in the State Department. The State Department has had its own very serious problems in this regard throughout government, at every level of government, in every industry. And so when I say I wonder what's next for Ronan Farrow, or what's next for anybody who's going to report on these sorts of things, to move it beyond entertainment and into other venues, I think it's important to see if that step happens.
I'm not moving it far from that, but let's talk about Serena Williams for a moment. So you have the Saturday U.S. Open women's final. It goes to Naomi Osaka, who became the first Japanese player to win a Grand Slam event. But the result overshadowed by a controversial dispute between Serena Williams and the chair umpire Carlos Ramos during the second set at Arthur Ashe Stadium. On Sunday, Williams was fined $17,000 for her role in the incident. She said, "You owe me an apology. I've never cheated in my life. I have a daughter, and I stand for what's right for her," she told Ramos on the court. "I don't cheat to win. I'd rather lose." Her point being that the male judge on the line judge was treating her much differently than Serena Williams believes that a male player would have been treated, and fined not only for the money but for a point that helped her lose the game.
Exactly. I can't even say on the air some of the things that John McEnroe, Andre Agassi, a lot of the men who I watched rise to fame. Pete Sampras was pretty quiet, but maybe he's an outlier. You know, there's to me clearly a double standard here in terms of not only the penalties waged by the chair umpire, but also the additional financial penalties levied against Serena Williams, which was after a rather favorable, sort of looked like a CYA statement by the USTA almost immediately after the press conference, saying, you know, sort of backpedaling what the chair umpire had done. So this is an unfolding story. This certainly isn't a surprise to Serena, who has been singled out a lot by a lot of people in this profession, in the professional sports industry, and I don't think it's surprising that it was in a finals match between two powerful women of color that this type of an incident occurred.
Could she have handled it better?
I think that's the wrong question.
Well, no, my question is, could she have handled the dispute on the court better? Could she have handled herself in a more professional way, or after the match, in a press conference in which she's definitely going to get all the attention she would want air her grievance. I'm thinking also about the opponent that was on the court at the time, who was basically, you know, a victim in all this as well, because her first major, a 20-year-old, has been tarnished as well. And I'm not saying Serena maybe didn't have a case. I'm just wondering if this was the, at some point, was it the right forum in which she needed to voice her objections?
If I were in the final, and I played tennis growing up, and I played tennis on varsity team in high school, so I feel very personally about this. But if I were in the finals of a Grand Slam at the U.S. Open, and Serena, if I remember this correctly, I think Serena and Venus also played after 9/11. Weren't they in the finals together?
Yeah.
This is a highly emotional space. 72 hours before the anniversary of 9/11, when she's coming back from maternity leave, having almost lost her life in the hospital giving birth, having just been told what to wear, I would have behaved much more aggressively than Serena
she's
Williams.
She's a 37-year-old champion who has been probably in every emotional, critical setting that could be in tennis.
But if not on the court, then where do you argue it?
You argue it after the court.
But then it's sour grapes.
I think she's willing to use her position to really make some serious statements. It's also interesting to see. She's prominently featured in the Colin Kaepernick Nike ad. That she, you know, I think in the, especially in this last year, with all the things that have happened that Sarah mentioned, you can see her, I think, taking a more prominent center stage, and that these confluence of things came together on the court. She reacted as she did. I think it was powerful.
Well, the artist, I'm sorry.
Well, when we see, so baseball is another context, and I saw this come up. You know, when the umpires throw players out, they're in each other's faces, right. And nobody says, could he have acted more professionally? It's usually...
And the players are thrown out of the game.
Right, but that's not anywhere close to what she did. That she was, right. She stood away from the umpire and challenged him on the call on its face without using obscenities or any profane language at all.
Thief is not an obscenity.
No, it's a fact.
But you can't. I mean, there are certain words that may not be obscenities, but they are just as
pretty
pointed.
Powerful.
Pretty
what are
powerful.
You blind, ump? Are you blind?
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, we have to go to news. But the other thing that to me the story could have been different, and Serena Williams could be painted in a harsher picture if she was not so supremely classy in the to make her point, but then separate that from giving the player her due for the woman who beat her, and telling the crowd to stop booing and to honor her.
Sure, but that still puts all of the attention on Serena and her reaction, which is always what happens with these situations when women are involved. Who's interviewing the ump? Who's asking
they tried.
Him?
He was out. He was. That was my understanding. He was gone. He was in a cab. He was.
I'm sure
they'll get him.
I think. But
that's how power works, right?
Ronan Farrow will find him.
Yes,
he gets to do that. Nobody is gonna follow him around asking him if he wore the right tie that day. It's insane.
Okay, so I'm only going to. I'm interested in this though, because it did seem to me that it is important to separate the two between the call and the and then the playing of the game. That seems to be an important separator that Serena saw very quickly.
Yes. Yep. And she's a class act, and the fact that she. She took the opportunity of that grand stage afterwards to tell the crowd straight that her opponent needed to have this moment when she was so clearly indignant and feeling very justified in her reaction speaks volumes to her sportsmanship.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have a lot of other stuff to discuss. We'll get to that. First news from Roy Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. 8 minutes past 10 o'clock, we have Alan Chartok, Jim Ketterer, Sarah Rogerson, and Barry Lewis with us this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Alan has a few to read to us, and then we'll move on, and we have other stuff to talk about.
Okay, Joe, thanks. Serena, ask the panelists who just questioned Serena's professionalism, has he ever asked a man if a man had made that choice? This belief that women have to behave differently than their male counterparts is part of what causes this discrimination. Wow, says Kathleen. Kajan says, Serena comment. I apologize. I do not know his name, but it is absolutely the wrong question to ask if Serena would have handled it better. That is a double standard we are talking about. When McEnroe acts out, it was called good for the sport, for entertainment. The man who asked the question is totally out of touch. And
I would have asked that about McEnroe as well, just to set the record straight.
And you're a sports writer, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And you were.
Yes.
Kevin says, could she? Could she have handled herself better? 4 question marks. Could McEnroe? 3 question marks. Really? And that's from Kevin. Anthony says, trolling. With this op-ed, was the New York Times trolling Trump? And I watched Active Measures, too. People need to watch this informative documentary film. And that's from Anthony. And Ray says, Democrats. Good morning, panel. My name is Ray. First time writing in. At what point do the Democrats get on the same page and start screaming at the top of their lungs that this administration has lost control of its leader? If Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are not going to lead, then step aside, put someone in their place who will lead. Just my opinion, says Ray. And finally, Peter says, anonymous op-ed. The author of the op-ed apparently believes that he or she is providing a necessary service. If this person were to come forward, he or she would have to stop, which would be a dangerous thing to do. And that's from Peter in New Paltz.
All right. Those are the letters, and you can add to the pile, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. All right. We'll talk to Jim about this, and then we'll get into the governor. CIA drone mission curtailed by Obama is expanded in Africa under Trump. This is a story that was published yesterday in the New York Times. The CIA is poised to conduct several secret drone strikes against Islamic State insurgents from a newly expanded airbase deep in the Sahara, making aggressive use of powers that were scaled back during the Obama administration and restored by President Trump. Late in his presidency, Barack Obama sought to put the military in charge of drone attacks after a backlash arose over a series of highly visible strikes, some of which killed civilians. The move was intended in part to bring greater transparency to attacks that the United States often refused to acknowledge its role in. But now the CIA is broadening its drone operations, moving aircraft to hunt Islamist militants in southern Libya. The expansion adds to the agency's limited covert missions in eastern Afghanistan for strikes in Pakistan and in southern Saudi Arabia for attacks in Yemen.
So tomorrow is the 17th anniversary of 9/11. And we have seen since 9/11 the CIA come back into being very active in operational activities. The CIA was given the opportunity to go in first to Afghanistan after the 9/11 attacks and given really expanded powers, taking the gloves off, as President George W. Bush said. During the Obama administration, as it says in the article, it was late in the administration that they changed this to the military. During the Obama administration, they used drones to a great extent, particularly in Yemen and Somalia, in Libya after the invasion of Libya and the complete breakdown of the rule of law there, in Syria as well. And when the CIA is carrying out these activities, as the article says, there is, because it's covert measures and it's an intelligence agency, certainly not the level of oversight and transparency in our constitutional system with civilian control. John Brennan, who now has been back in the news as he's lost his security clearance from Trump, was overseeing these when he was CIA director for Obama. And I think the article understates the number of civilian deaths that were caused by these drone strikes, particularly in Yemen. They would count the civilian casualties in a very tricky way. They would basically say any male who was of military age who happened to be killed in these strikes outside of who the target was will be counted as an enemy combatant. So many of the human rights organizations and others were very concerned about this, and it was the Obama administration responding to that pressure that changed this. Another thing I think that's important about this story is that many Americans have no idea what the U.S. is up to in Africa. You may recall that about a year ago, 4 U.S. soldiers were killed in an ambush in Niger, where this base is. And even members of Congress were surprised to find out that we had ongoing combat activities, or at least combat support activities, in Africa under our regional command called AFRICOM. So Niger is in the middle of a variety of hotspots. Mali to the east of it, Libya, which is just a complete kind of open zone of an arms market, of all kinds of violence that emanates from it throughout the region, migrants crossing the Mediterranean from Libya. It really is a highly problematic area. And so to decide to bring the CIA back into this and remove it from the military is really an important decision. And this is all done. All these attacks are carried out under a very loose authorization, broad authorization that was put in place after 9/11, this authorization for the use of military force. And I notice, as every member of the House is up for election this year, I don't think many members, no matter what party they're in, are being asked, where do you stand on that authorization for the use of military force? Where do you stand on this particular policy, the use of drones in Africa, or the U.S. involvement in Yemen, or the Trump administration announced at the end of last week we're going to have troops indefinitely stay in Syria? I think it's important for people to realize that we've been at war for 17 years following 9/11, and that the Congress should play a crucial role in this. They fund these activities. They're authorizing these activities. And I don't see people holding those members' feet to the fire.
So, Jim, is the barn door now so open that it's too late?
Too late for people to
retake the power of oversight for the Congress, and or is it just since John Foster Dulles, and I may be the only one in the room to remember it pretty well, but, you know, that's exactly what was going on. We see it all around the world. I believe we're seeing it in Venezuela now. You know, there is this whole business. Is anybody gonna step in and say it's time to close the door?
Yeah, I mean, we have seen an incredible centralization of power in the presidency as it relates to these sorts of activities before 9/11, but certainly following it on steroids. And it's not reserved just for presidents of one party over the other. This is a trend that transcends partisan politics. And this is a direction of the kind of rejiggering power in our constitutional system in a way that some people would argue is simply not the way that was expected by the founders of the Republic, that the Congress has in many ways ceded their role in making these very difficult decisions.
I thought it was interesting that these are not drones that many people would think of. You think of a drone, it's this, 3 foot wide by three, this thing that kind of goes up, and these are 27-foot-long Predator drones, and the impact and the power that they have and what they're able to deliver in terms of missiles is extraordinary.
Yeah, it is extraordinary, and one of the cases that really brought this into sharp relief was during the Obama administration when Anwar el-Awlaki, an American citizen, was targeted and was killed in Yemen without due process. And the legal justification that was given after that fact goes right back to that authorization to use military force from the Congress. Awlaki's 16-year-old son was killed 2 weeks later. And his 8-year-old daughter was killed more recently during the Trump administration. You know, I think these are really serious issues that people should be wrestling with, because these things ultimately are being done in our name. This isn't just some sort of separate entity out there. This is happening under the name of the United States. And it has real impacts, not only in what's happening on the ground, but also what does it mean about who gets to make these decisions?
Yeah, and I know it's been underreported as well, but I think it was last summer, the New York Times did a series of stories on the number of drone attacks and whether or not the reporting is accurate about the number and the damage incurred by civilians. There is a fund to compensate civilians who have had property destroyed or you know, not that you can compensate for this, but who have had family members killed as a result of drone strikes. It's underfunded. It's underutilized. People don't know about it. And quite frankly, the people who have come forward have gotten peanuts. So it's a, again, goes back to that norm erosion that started before this presidency, but I'm particularly concerned about it now. In terms of what this president will do with that kind of power.
We have some letters. We will go to those, and then we'll see if we have time for one more topic.
Okay, Joe. Serena plays the game, says Keith, on the court, but if you wanted to take it up at a press conference right after the fact, the chair took this game right then and there from her. Guess which USTA player received orders to take the most drugs during their time playing for the USTA? Serena Williams. They have targeted Serena during her entire time playing tennis.
True.
And John says, Serena, yes, but Serena has won 25 Grand Slams and tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. She's hardly a victim of tennis, whatever its shortcomings. Her opponent made history, and that was her moment, and it has been forever marred. The fact is, Serena was badly outplayed and was on her way to losing this one anyway. It wasn't stolen from her. Class would have meant limiting the histrionics and soldiering on. Her opponent showed great class. Andy says, Serena's coach admitted to hand signals to Serena during the confrontation with the umpire that he saw and called. The hand signals were for her to stop arguing. And make of it what you will, I wouldn't have called it. The racket abuse penalty is hard not to call. The verbal abuse call was entirely unfounded. The situation was unfortunate and spiraled out of control quickly. If you compare the women's final umpire to the umpire that encouraged Nick Kyrgios not to give up earlier in the tournament, you can attribute it to the sexism or that there is wide degree in umpiring conduct. And that's from Andy.
That wasn't a sexist. I mean, I think that was also universal condemnation, where an umpire should not come down from the chair and encourage this player and say, I've seen you do better. Come on. You can do it. Yeah, that's you know, I don't think anyone was thinking that was good either.
That's just bizarre.
Yeah, that was bizarre.
And Kathy says, Serena, hi, guys. I would go a step further. My sense is that the chair judge was punishing Serena for daring, in capital letters, to wear a non-traditional outfits and then daring to speak about it, as if he and his white men in white pants club has been personally insulted. Well, they had. Yes, I'm reading a bit into it, but frankly, it's hard for me not to. This is the way the old boys club works, and I don't even care about tennis. Jill says, the focus has been on the fact that she's female. She's also African-American. Would she be treated the same way if she were white, male, or female? I seriously doubt it.
I think that's a good point. And I, you know, in the swamp of social media, just looking through Twitter last night, some of the comments I saw that were on that very point that were ugly and really just bringing out some of the worst, I think, in people. And I think that shouldn't be overlooked. That's an important letter.
Did you want to add? No, okay. Let's go to the story. I'm just going to bring it up here real quick. We have a few moments regarding the governor of New York State. Interesting article in the New York Times this morning as we tick down to the primary, which is on Thursday. Let's not forget. So an inappropriate mailer and a delayed bridge opening put Cuomo on the defensive. It must have seemed like just a fine idea. On Friday, Governor Cuomo was standing alongside his mother, Matilda, and Hillary Clinton, celebrating the grand opening of the eastbound span of the Gleaming Bridge bearing his father's name. Emotional words were spoken, selfies were taken, but that span never opened as planned on Saturday as engineers cited a potentially dangerous situation. Then a second problem erupted for Mr. Cuomo on Saturday when a flyer landed in the mailboxes of Jewish New Yorkers, a political mailer paid for by the State Democratic Committee, the State Democratic Party, that Mr. Cuomo funds, tying together a photograph of his opponent, Cynthia Nixon, and the loaded words, anti-Semitism. The flyer drew swift rebukes from fellow Democrats as Mr. Cuomo distanced himself from its content. And all of this to be said that there is a poll out today from Siena that I believe has showing the governor 40 points ahead. So
going up in the polls.
Okay. Who would like to begin?
Yeah, I just think it's interesting that the man who's got his pulse on everything, who nothing moves in Albany without his say-so, who certainly was directing this bridge being built, who heads the Democratic Party in the state, has absolutely no idea what's going on regarding the opening of the bridge and his flyer that comes out just days before the primary. What a shock. A bizarre coincidence, as he
and
likes to call it.
And who does it go to, Barry? Who does it go to?
Who does the flyer go to?
Yes.
It goes to Jewish voters.
But particularly to Orthodox Jewish voters.
Those Orthodox Jewish voters that Cuomo has been in bed with, to say the least. I mean, we have reported on his pay-to-play and his, lack of transparency in terms of the funding and how he has wielded power in Albany for the Orthodox, the growing Orthodox community in parts of certainly in the Hudson Valley and in New York City. That is a very strong voting block, and he continues, as other politicians have, to grab it and control it.
But why do you think that if he's truly up 40 points, did somebody feel the need to send out that flyer? Why do something that risky?
That's a great question. Could I just take a second and ask why Dick Nixon, who was going to win his election, feel compelled to break into the Watergate?
Yes. Yeah, that was that
psychologist. We need a psychologist on the back, perhaps. Yeah.
All right. That is it for time. And my thanks to everybody, Barry Lewis, Sarah Rogerson, Jim Ketterer, Alan Chartok. Thank you all for being with us. We will continue after this short break.